the river, flowing in my soul. There's a river.
In this episode, my colleague Rich Long will speak with Sophia Rodriguez, co-author of the third paper in the National Academy series, Supporting Families and Communities in Children's Academic Thriving and Well-Being in the Wake of the COVID-19 Pandemic. This paper examines the educational impacts of COVID-19, the racial reckoning that unfolded alongside it, and the ongoing challenges facing children, students, families, and schools. The paper explores how the pandemic exacerbated longstanding inequalities, how families and communities responded, and how schools can rethink engagement and learning in more collaborative, equitable ways. Sophia Rodriguez is an associate professor of educational leadership and policy studies and the sociology of education at New York University. Her research addresses racial equity, urban education, leadership and policy, and the importance of centering minoritized youth voices. She founded and directs the Immigrant Ed Next Research Lab, a public-facing research hub that involves mentoring doctoral students in multiple projects about how districts, schools, and community-based organizations can create spaces of belonging for immigrant youth. As a first-generation college student and PhD, she values mentoring and providing students with research experiences. Before joining NYU, Dr. Rodriguez had a tenure-track faculty position at the University of Maryland, College Park. She started her education career teaching middle school ELA in New York City public schools in the South Bronx, and she's taught high school English and ESL in Chicago. Rich Long, who has 45 years in education public policy, will interview Sophia. The interview will touch on the major themes from her research, examples of community-driven initiatives, and what educators, policymakers, and researchers can take away as we continue navigating the post-pandemic landscape.
What, from your perspective of your paper and the issues that you were covering, were the effects on, and what are the ongoing effects of COVID?
Yeah, so I think one of the major things that we tried to articulate in our paper were, yes, COVID happened, as well as the murder of George Floyd and the racial reckoning in our country, which I think we really would be remiss not to mention as well. Those things converged on family and community life, but at the same time, pre-existing inequalities also were at play. And so I think we think about the inequities in the aftermath of COVID, which certainly are significant, but they also exacerbated existing inequalities that racially, ethnically minoritized families and communities already experience. So that's where we start, just to acknowledging that in our paper. And then some of the actual things that we looked at were to try to think through what was it that schools were doing to support families and communities during pre-post-COVID. And I think there was a deep impact. But our paper, instead of thinking about it from the lens of what interventions were done or could be done, we actually started by also calling into question the way that we think about intervention and calling into question some of those deficit based narratives about families and communities within the public school system. Because I think historically schools, even with their best intentions, have approached intervention or approached families from a deficit perspective. And by that, what we mean is we think, oh, we're going to do an event intervention. That means something needs to be fixed. There's a problem that needs to be diagnosed. And we've been doing that for decades, and yet inequality persists, and schools are not structured necessarily to support learning and growing for kids who might not have other opportunities or spaces to get additional support. And so that's where my colleague Anne Ishimaru and I start in our paper, by just maybe calling into question what we mean by engaging families and what we mean by intervention? And could we maybe think about more family or community-centered collaborations and partnerships that we could tap into rather than trying to force some sort of top-down or hierarchical intervention upon families and communities?
When you talk about engagement, what do you mean when you say that?
Yeah, I think my colleague Anne has sort of spent a long time thinking about what this means in her work. So I want to acknowledge that. And I think in my own work, what we mean is what do families and young people bring to the table that we might build on, or what might be an untapped resource, a cultural or linguistic asset that's not reflected in the school structure or the systems or the curriculum or programs, whatever it may be. And so, starting with, again, questions for families that they want to see prioritized or centralized, young people's experiences. That's my work. I've spent decades working to highlight youth voice in education. And so I think that's a huge part of engagement, is that schools, again, historically think to engage means you send a letter home or you send an iPad home and you expect that something is going to be different. Or you don't, right? Or you don't translate into other languages. There's a variation, obviously, what happens across schools. But I think thinking about engagement and partnerships and collaboration as reciprocal, as centering the voices and experiences, priorities and needs of those who will be impacted by a policy or a program. Because I don't think we always do that in education. And then we wonder why outcomes are not positive and why inequalities are persisting.
How would you summarize your paper?
What I just shared was a framing that we did, which we did go back and forth quite a bit around when we were engaging in revisions for the paper. But we had three guiding questions for our paper that we pursued in relation to this framing and critique of traditional intervention or traditional ways of engagement with families and communities. So, one of our research questions or guiding questions was, how did the pandemic shape the educational experiences of youth, families, and communities, particularly those who are marginalized in educational systems? A second guiding question for our paper was, given the experiences, because I should also say we really did focus on the experiences of racially, ethnically minoritized students in our work, and what system-led initiatives or community and family-led initiatives existed, because we wanted to also highlight work that was being done in communities, which again is not always privileged because it may not be seen as like traditional academic work or traditional interventionist work. But because Anne and I work and are so embedded in communities, we know that work exists and we wanted to showcase it. Whether it was peer review published or empirically driven, we thought it was important to share. So that was the second question. And then the third question was just around what family and community models might look like on the ground. And Anne and I drew on our own current work where community models have been particularly powerful in Maryland and Washington around mental health supports for immigrant families. In my work, that's what I studied, and then parent engagement projects in Anne's work that she studied. So, what we found across each of those questions, just to summarize briefly, how did the pandemic shape the educational experiences? It exacerbated inequalities for racially, ethnically minoritized students, is our finding for that. And then, around what types of system and family and community-led initiatives, we had a lot of variation. And so, what we did was we tried to summarize the types of partnerships, the types of collaborations that we saw that existed. Because traditionally, you might see a community school partnership or a partnership between a local public school and maybe a community-based organization that runs programs or has some sort of direct services or other sort of youth development type programming. That's one type of partnership we looked at because those community models are often driven by the partnership goals. So, community schools, for instance, would be one example of this where you have maybe funding that's dictating maybe the outcomes of those partnerships, academic and social emotional alike. But we were also really interested in what other types of partnerships could exist that could support families and communities. And so, in the world of that I work in, which is around immigrant groups and immigration related issues, I've studied a lot of community-based organizations that prioritize youth voice and immigrant rights issues. And so tapping into, are we trying to empower parents? Are we trying to teach them about activism? Are we trying to build political capital for them to advocate for themselves? Or are we holding ESL classes or workforce training? So is it more kind of skill development or direct service related? Are there mental health supports or needs in the community? So those were the different types of things we tried to uncover. There were a host of different types of parent engagement and work, like teacher home visits with parents. That's some of the work that Anne talked about in her, some of the past work she's done. And so just looking at all of those different types of ways that families were engaged. Anne's work also has looked at parent leadership training. So again, I guess that fits under the empowerment model, but generally we found that community-led initiatives were took different forms. So they could take a form, like I said, of direct service, identifying specific needs and targeting programs, or more development, empowerment, advocacy, building political capital in the community to support families in the ways that they best see fit. So that was some of the summary around part two or question two. And then the last question we pursued was, like I mentioned, not necessarily a super robust area of empirical research, but we thought it was really important to highlight. And so, within some of those community-centered initiatives, I'll just give one example from my own work that I talk about in the paper, which was a non-clinical community-based mental health initiative that a local community-based organization developed. They built capacity within their staff to basically run an immigrant mother group. And to support, it started out as a safe space during the pandemic. So it started out as Zoom meetings every week for immigrant mothers, where they could just come together, talk through things they were facing around fear, anxiety during the pandemic, and also navigating immigration issues and immigration status issues and potential access issues to public and social resources. And what started as just a Zoom meeting became not only did they build connection and solidarity, but then they were like, oh, we want to learn about mental health issues. We want to learn about anxiety. We want to do all this so that we can support our kids. And then we ended up also building out a youth component. So it was an intergenerational, non-clinical mental health intervention, for lack of a better word. So it was really neat because as a researcher, I was there to support. I served on like the evaluation team for the project and helped support in getting the grant funding. But really, this was driven by the community-based organization who were staff that happened to be Latino, mostly, not all immigrants, but really understood the needs of the community, partnered with the local high schools to say, hey, we want to test out this type of model and bring together youth and mothers and think about how that communication across generations is going on as well. And that was a 2-year project that we rolled out when we started actually this paper. So that was something, again, there was not peer-reviewed research on, but we felt was important to share as an example of a community-identified need and then a program and a research project that we developed around it.
Are there any examples you want to just pull out and highlight in total?
I think one of the things that we also highlighted in the paper from looking at all of these different models were some core principles. So I think in addition to the specific example of a potentially, like a potential type of community-led initiative, we also found that there were just some collaborative principles that might be useful for people doing research of this nature. So thinking about, as I've already mentioned several times, just beginning with community and family ecologies. And what we mean by that are like understanding the systems and communities that you're working in. So again, I think part of our critique at the outset of the paper, or the framing of the paper that I mentioned, is that as schools or as even sometimes researchers, we think we might know what would be best for a community or what has positive effects and therefore needs to be replicated as an intervention. And I believe in that. I'm a scientist, so I totally believe in that. But at the same time, I think in the wake of COVID, in all of that's been happening in our country and that continues to happen, particularly around vulnerable communities, there needs to be a safety and a trust that's built if we're going to engage in community-based work as researchers. And so understanding the ecology of families and communities, I think, is critical. Also, trying to think through the power dynamics and flattening hierarchies when we're doing engaged research, I think, is something that Anne and I really privileged in our community-based work. Also, enacting some sort of collective decision making. That's something that we didn't really talk about yet. I think, in addition to having families or youth or communities identify their needs, a lot of the work I've done with youth over the past decade has been asking them, like, what do you see as the most important pressing issue for you? And they might be able to name it, but then where they get frustrated is in school settings, they don't see their voice incorporated into the decision-making process around developing an intervention or a program or a policy or a practice. And so I think not just asking families, that's often a hard first step, but also showing them along the way that their voice is being incorporated into whatever it is you're trying to do in terms of engagement or building partnership or developing an intervention. And then I think also the last thing we mentioned as part of our kind of core collaborative principles is some kind of way to adjust and evolve. Because I think, again, sometimes schools' approaches to intervention are linear, for lack of a better word. And that's just not the nature of, I think, how communities and human beings respond or evolve. And so knowing that you could build an infrastructure to support families and communities, but you need to revisit what that looks like throughout the process of whatever it is they're trying to do. So those were some of the kind of core principles we developed for researchers to be thinking about.
What should practitioners take away from your work, your observations, what you're thinking about now, plus your paper?
There are a couple things that we thought were important for practitioners, and this is something I can also share because I know you mentioned going beyond what we did to what we're doing. I think enhancing data use was a big thing that came up in like research evidence use. So I work a lot with school districts and community-based organizations, and people are obsessed with data. What's the data? What's the data? Is I hear that a lot. But then I'm like, what do you guys, how do you define data? I think that was something that, especially in K-12 spaces, we wanted to support because I think that there's confusion about what research really is. And there's a lot of people who aren't actually researchers who provide toolkits and packets of information that schools then buy and try to implement. And I don't know, and this, I'm a researcher, so I'm sensitive to this, but I do think that for practitioners, having space, either at a district-wide level or at a school-wide level, where they can actually wrestle with not just like what data and research exist, but who are their constituents, who are their stakeholders, who are their populations that they're serving. One of the school districts I do a lot of work with now, over half of their kids are Latino and immigrant families. And I've been working at the district level with the principals and other educators to think about their equity planning. And many of the school, like the school-based educators, don't know just the basic demographics of their population. So I think for practitioners, like, and especially district leaders and school leaders, communicating at multiple levels who your population is a big piece of aligning relevant, culturally appropriate, whatever phrase you want to use, work. And that can be research-based, that can be research use in that practice. So that was something we talked about in the paper as well. I think our other point around the analysis of different community and community-led initiatives and family engagement, we did highlight that localized interventions, highly contextualized interventions are going to be necessary. And this is really challenging because from an academic perspective and even a funding perspective, we want big RCTs and things that can be replicated. And sometimes that just doesn't work in some communities. So we also
What
recommend
does RCT mean?
random control trials. It's a type of experimental design. And I think I understand from a science perspective why that's important and what that can yield. But I think being embedded in communities allows us to have a more holistic approach to intervention and to improving well-being and mental health outcomes, not just academic ones. Because I think that was another kind of takeaway, is there's so much focus on academic intervention, and in the wake of COVID and in the wake of racial reckoning, as well as the ongoing attacks and threats to communities nationwide, we have to think about mental health. We have to think about well-being and flourishing, not just do kids do well on a test, because there's more to it than that.
What would you say are the common threads within all three papers?
It's a great question. I think so across the three papers, I do think that each tried to engage with this idea of intervention, not just academically. I think the social emotional component was really coming through, and we didn't talk about it in terms of social emotional necessarily, but I think by proxy, thinking about families and communities and the way that they're leading the work and being empowered to lead work, I think that is a form of tending to the social emotional needs of families and communities. I think one of the papers highlighted that specifically. And then the first paper, even though it was a summary of academic interventions in many ways, I do think that there was attention to what interventions didn't work and what they didn't account for. And I think building off of that first paper on implementing programs to align, accelerate, and extend student learning, I think we picked up the paper in that sense where they identified the gaps in some of the academic interventions. I think our paper was the dovetail to that, if that makes sense. Yeah, I think the other thing, I think our paper laid out again these types of family and community-led initiatives and potential for building systems from community and family perspectives. Whereas I think David's paper really laid out specific conditions for how that work could be done. I don't know that we did that enough, because I think a lot of our work, as I mentioned, especially toward the latter part of the paper, is ongoing. We're still studying it and trying to understand. And there's always a risk, because I think Anne and I are both committed to doing work that privileges community and family voice, but then we don't necessarily want to codify it, because that would go potentially against this idea that this work is highly contextualized and localized. But at the same time, we need a little bit of codification around the types of supports or conditions that could potentially increase, like I said, well-being, flourishing. And I do think David's paper is the one that really laid out those types of conditions for that.
Two questions now that are somewhat specific. One of them, you mentioned about decision making at the local level, and then went on to talk about how students are frustrated that their opinion might be asked about something, but they see nothing resulting from that. What sort of decision, and you also mentioned about top down not being the way to go. Where do you think schools should go and are going, and what have you seen?
Yeah, so I guess this takes a little bit a next step from the paper, because this wasn't in the paper, my answer to this. But yeah, so I think on the one hand, many schools are finding ways to incorporate youth perspectives into their work. I know schools in Massachusetts as well as in Pennsylvania that have youth councils, or if there's an equity team or a leadership team at the district level or even at the school level, that there's student representation on those type of entities. I think one of the school districts that I do a lot of work with, I'll just give that example, and I think it's an ongoing process. I don't necessarily think this is exemplary yet. I think they're on their way. This particular district developed an equity plan that was passed by the district, very thoughtful. There's a whole section in there on how to improve the welcoming climate for students. Because of the 3,000 kids or so in their middle and high schools, over 80% are students of color. Like I said, half are Latino or Latinx and immigrant backgrounds, parents who are immigrants, etc. And yet there's very few opportunities for parents to attend events, come to school, be a part of the school. And so this district was thinking about how do we build climates that are supportive, that are welcoming. I'm the researcher, so I've done survey research with the district to identify the areas where kids don't feel a sense of belonging. And that's been the bulk of my work over the past couple of years. But many kids report, that teachers don't have positive views about their races or ethnicities, and or that they experience racial incidents in the school, either among peers or among adults, meaning like racist comments are said, and then they're left unaddressed. And so from that survey research, then I did focus groups with kids. And I think one thing that's been really cool and positive about this district is as I'm in a research practice partnership with them. And so I report the data that I find, and then they actually incorporate it into their equity planning process. So they've developed a couple interventions for educators around learning about equity work, learning about working with populations who are different from them, because most of the teachers in the school district, as is common across public schools in the country, are white and female, and the student demographics are not that. And just increasing kind of racial awareness around the teachers' or educators' experiences has been something really important. They've also developed an immigration working group where educators can learn more about immigration policy and how that's affecting their communities. There's been examples of ICE raids in the community. And so there's an aftermath. Kids aren't coming to school. Families suddenly are being torn apart. And all we're hearing from kids is we need some mental health support. And so I think the district is really trying to listen to build supports. And they are starting with the educators because the hypothesis is that if you improve awareness and build a positive racial literacy within the educator group, that student belonging and school climate will also improve. And again, we're in the middle of this work, but it's the first time I've really seen a district be super intentional about actually collecting student level data through the survey I've done on student belonging and the focus groups I've done to flesh out some of those survey findings. And I think it's hard work. There's one person in this equity role that's charged with it all, and that's very taxing. But I'm sure there's other examples of schools doing this kind of work. It's just I'm speaking to the one that I obviously do. But I think that's a way to, because kids notice that stuff when you talk to them about issues they're facing and then nothing comes of it. That's what I hear about in the focus groups. When they tell me examples of things they've experienced, and as a researcher, then I've presented to the board, I've presented to the district leadership, I've presented to the principals in the district as well. I think it's pretty shocking and jarring for the adults to hear, but I think that's good. And I'm seeing them actually incorporate youth voice into building educator awareness and racial literacy and equity literacy. So that's just one example.
That's neat. Another topic, artificial intelligence empowered by large language models are attempting to be friendly to people and they can help people to change their approach to learning and engagement. How do you see that?
This is interesting. I have been in conversation with a few educators in my research about this topic. I am very nervous about AI. I am not gung-ho. If I understand your question, I think it's potentially very useful for educators as a tool. I think the worry I have is that there's research going on that's looking at the effectiveness of AI interventions and the use of AI in teacher practice and pedagogy, but there's not a ton of questioning it. We're jumping, I think, full steam into it, and that worries me. Also, I've never used ChatGPT, so I don't even want to go there, frankly. But I think what I worry about is anytime we lean on a tool and not question, like, where that's coming from or what it is, I think we run a risk. I'm anti-AI, so you can cut this part of the segment if you want. But I do know that in the district that I'm working with, they're using AI for a lot of the ESL curriculum and stuff. And I think it's useful to some extent, again, because teachers can type in, write me a lesson plan, and that saves time. And I think for teachers who are super tasked and strapped, like it can be amazingly useful, but also AI is culling information. It's not necessarily questioning where that information is coming from. I don't know. I just worry about that. I'm not really sure if that answers your
No,
question,
it
but
does. I think it was a well-nuanced answer. Yeah,
just one of the teachers in the study sent me the platform that his district is making him use for the. So he's a mainstream teacher, like teaches English language arts, but he has a number of language learners in his class. And so they've built out this whole AI generated curriculum for language learners. And it's all this weird stuff that I'm like, how would a kid from Venezuela know what that reference is? It's just not thinking about language in context because it's trying to help be efficient. And I think that tension for me is very real. I used to teach language learners. I was an ESL teacher, and I was laughing with him. I'm like, I used to take my kids to the supermarket, and that's how we learned what apples and oranges were. I don't need Google to help me with that. But anyway, I think it's going to be an ongoing tension for
Yeah,
sure.
part of what you're talking about is just its rawness.
Yeah, you had asked what I mean by engagement at the outset. I also talk in these examples about what I mean by partnership. And so, one of the really unique projects I worked on that I talk about in the paper is about a partnership that a school district had with a public library. And I think that was, it's been my, it was my favorite project I've done to date. And I had like scholarly output from it, but that was so secondary to this project. I did like a program evaluation, and it was a library-based after-school program that was set up for newcomer immigrant students in Hartford, Connecticut. And just the unwavering dedication of thinking about the library as a democratic space, as a hub for families and kids. It was a really dynamic library. There was a partnership with UConn, so like college students were often in the library. There was a youth digital media lab where just kids could go into to use different technologies. Like I tried to go in there once and I was literally told to get out because it was a youth space. And kids really felt ownership within their public library, which was really cool. And then the after school program was a partnership with the school district and, like I said, the library. And it was all around learning English, but learning it in context. So the kids, we developed a curriculum. There were other people involved, obviously, not just me, the project, but it was a true multifaceted partnership. There were language learner teachers. There was a district level person who oversaw all the English as a second language teachers. There was the library person who oversaw the library stuff. There were social workers and counselors that were brought in because mental health issues came up as a need. There was partnerships with UConn for those social work interns. So it was just a really neat partnership that kind of took off and went beyond the grant funding that we had. And I think it helped. Again, there were direct services for parent, like parents could come in because it was a public library, use computers, apply for jobs, help get help with resume stuff. And so I think that partnership served a specific need in that community because of the population, the increase of newcomers into the area. And it was reciprocal. Kids took ownership over their learning, but also got to learn about the community. And so one of the kind of highlights of that program and project were newcomers developed like a digital kind of book to support other newcomers. And that was identified through my focus groups with them, where they were like, we came to this country and we didn't know how to navigate anything. We didn't know what was in the community. We didn't know what it was like to go to these big comprehensive high schools. And so we don't want other newcomers to feel like that. So we want to create something for them so that when they come here, they can know what to do. And that was really powerful. And then the kids presented back at the high school to the teachers to say, hey, this is what we experienced. So we did something to fix that. It was just a really, it's one of my favorite projects. So we highlight that curriculum and that type of partnership because I think public libraries, unfortunately, as is everything right now, funding is being cut, but those are really central hubs in communities that are untapped resources as well, particularly for, I think, vulnerable populations. So I guess I would add that to the other example I gave.
Yeah, I think that's a great example. Anything in summary you want to say before we sign off?
Yeah, I guess in summary, the la one of the last things I would mention, we talked a little bit about implications for policy and potential practice support. In addition to some of the things I already said around the guiding principles that we offered for potentially researchers or thinking about policymakers potentially to enhance data capacity, state level data in particular, evidence use built into state systems. We talked a little bit about that. The last thing we didn't mention was funding. This was something that came up in our discussions over the course of writing the paper. We called upon philanthropic organizations who are essential, particularly in education research and in helping develop and grow research practice partnerships, which is a buzzword. And I think we do go beyond RPPs to talk about different types of partnerships, really calling for funders to recognize some of these more localized initiatives or community-led initiatives that they might need some kind of seed funding to build an empirical base to say, hey, this actually is working. Because a lot of times funding will go to the types of interventions or maybe projects that we say that might not work here. We might need to look a little more locally. So that was just the last piece that I think we had hoped, again, because these partnerships, like I mentioned, even in my own work, are long term, and to be sustained, you need to support people's time and to enhance or build capacity. And funding to support those efforts, I think, are really important.
Sophia, thank you.
In part one, Sarah Wolfen and Rob Jagers helped us see the system, the strategies, the pressures, and the challenges of making learning, well-being, and implementation work together in a moment shaped by political tension and rising mental health needs. In part two, Sophia Rodriguez asked us to look more closely at the people, whose voices are centered, whose knowledge counts, and what becomes possible when youth, families, and communities are treated as partners, not as problems to be solved. Part three brings these threads together. Joe Bishop and Karen Pittman invite us to zoom out and to imagine what it looks like to organize learning as an ecosystem, one built on relationships, belonging, and shared responsibility across schools and communities. This conversation challenges us to move from recovery to coherence, and to ask what it would take for every young person to experience learning that is connected, human, and designed around who they are and who they are becoming.
Yeah.